This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Bob Komsic.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Sunday edition of the best of Fight Back. More of what you want to hear from the week that was. If you think congestion on our roads is a big problem now, it's about to get worse, possibly a lot worse, meaning complaining's about to get louder. The city says the Gardiner Expressway is going to be reduced to two lanes in each direction between Dufferin and Strawn for 3 years, beginning as early as this month. That, of course, is for the controversial rehabilitation of the Gardiner, which has been debated at City Hall for years. Libby spoke with Toronto's chief engineer, Jennifer Graham Harkness.
We're beginning the construction activities. It'll begin this coming Monday, and we're going to be doing some intermittent lane closures. So what we'll be doing is reducing, beginning with the eastbound lanes, we'll be reducing it by one lane so we can do what we call pre-construction work. And then once the work on the eastbound lanes is done, we will be moving over to the westbound lanes and doing some pre-construction work there. Those lanes will be open during the long weekend that's coming, and then the following weekend as well, including the Monday. And then around mid-April, we will reduce the Gardiner down to two lanes in each direction, and we'll begin the full-on construction of the replacement of the bridge, the bridge deck, the road surface that carries traffic, as well as work underneath.
And I gather, though, all of this construction is going to be paused for the World Cup, even though that's not imminent.
Yes. So the work's going to take 3 years to complete, but we we're well aware of the World Cup. So the plan is, and it's been included in the contract, that we'll pause construction during the period when the World Cup is on, open the Gardiner up to full traffic flow, and get people moving through through the city for the World Cup.
You're talking about 3 years. What are the chances that this actually takes 3 years and doesn't go longer?
So we've worked really hard in terms of looking at how the work will progress and the staging and the construction activities. Our contractor has been involved in terms of looking at the how to sequence the work. And so right now we have plans that it will take 3 years. We may encounter some challenges. It is complex, but we expect it's going to take 3 years. And we do have provisions in place that if we encounter delays, our contractor is expected to get the work done on time. And there's provisions there if they don't.
In other words, financial penalties if they don't?
Correct.
Have you done any work on how much this is going to slow things down for people who are driving along that road?
We do know it's going to have a significant impact on traffic. We've done a number of things in terms of looking at traffic modeling and seeing how we can make adjustments across the network of traffic signals and other work so that we can, what I would say, reduce the impacts and improve traffic flow in other areas while the Gardiner's under construction.
Have you done any studies that say if you're going between point A and point B, it's going to take X amount of minutes longer?
We did look at the traffic. We have done traffic modeling. In terms of exact minutes, I think it's difficult to say what the specific impact is going to be for traffic, because each person has got a different path, and there could be other things that impact it. What we do with the traffic modeling is we look at if we were to adjust signal timing here and perhaps put traffic folks out there, will improve the traffic flow. So we use that traffic information for that. It will be busy, there will be congestion, and so my recommendation would be to, add extra time to plan your trip, and if possible, use other means of transportation. Transit is a great option.
Toronto's chief engineer, Jennifer Graham Harkness. This is Zoomer Radio's Best to Fight Back. I'm Bob Komsic for Jane Brown. Maybe you or someone you know doesn't have to be told just how many vehicles were stolen across Toronto last year, but the police chief provided the numbers the other day regardless. More than 12,000, or one every 40 minutes. There have also been close to 70 carjackings so far this year, more than double from the same time last year, while break-and-enters for the purpose of car theft have already exceeded the total number for all of last year. Ottawa, of course, hosted a summit recently, and Libby held her own with Elliot Silverstein of CAA Insurance, criminal defense lawyer Ari Goldkind, and security expert and former Toronto police officer Ross McLean to discuss this troubling trend.
These car thefts are being driven by international crime rings that support terrorism, drug smuggling. Hezbollah has a lot of people over here doing it. And what happens now, Libby, there's an online network for car thieves. They actually go by, they'll look to see the VIN number on the dashboard of your car, they'll scan it, then they'll upload it to a website, they'll look to see what features are on those cars, and someone will say if they'll buy that one, if they'll steal it or not, over in Africa, and what they'll pay for it. Then they get the list of the cars, they go out and they steal them, the car stealers get paid off, somehow probably online, they deliver it to someone else who then drives it to the docks, they get paid online by somebody else, the guy at the dock loads it up onto a container, he gets his little piece of it, off it goes to the other country, the person who receives that car gets a little piece of it, and then a $100,000 car here gets sold for $300,000 in Africa. You can actually look it up for doing that. So there absolutely is a complete criminal network for this. You'll get kids 14, 15, 16-year-olds doing this because they can make $1,000, $1,500 at a time for doing this.
Elliot Silverstein, the numbers that I've seen on insurance are staggering, that it has cost insurance companies something like $1.2 billion and added about $130 to the average bill. And that's not the bill of the people whose cars are considered most desirable.
The impact on the industry has been significant, and we're not seeing any changes. And that's part of the problem, is that we want to see the financial impacts go down. And that's why we have really been saying that everybody has to do their part, because the average consumer should not be having to shoulder the costs for a lot of these incidents. We need to see, you know, we're already seeing law enforcement at the table doing some pieces. We're seeing the conversations happening. What we need to see is tighter vehicle standards from the federal government. We need to see auto manufacturers putting in the necessary technologies to keep these cars safe. You know, again, for the average consumer, you know, they're trying to do their best to keep their car locked up, things put away, and listening to the tips that are being provided. But that can only go so far. And what we don't want to see is that consumers end up paying for it in the pocketbook even further because there's been inaction in other areas.
There are a lot of people, Ari, who say that it's really the onus is on the manufacturers to make the cars harder to steal.
What any conversation about what law-abiding people should do, whether it's their keys, how they park, whether they buy the club, what car manufacturers do, is utterly ludicrous to me. It's ludicrous. We either live in a safe society where we put carjackers, home invaders away, we change the YCJA, the Youth Criminal Justice Act, which has become a joke, which your guest alluded to, which is 14 and 15-year-olds do this because they know even if they get pinched, the court will apologize to them and say, rap on the hand the way it was like a young fight 30 years ago where two kids shouldn't really have a criminal record. This is a level of violence that nobody wants to talk about. We either live in a Canada that values law and order and that law-abiding people can drive around and go to bed at night without waking up in the morning and going, I wonder if my car is in the driveway. To me, it's insane. And for any of your listeners who go, well, this really doesn't affect me, I live outside of the madness. The madness is coming to you, and when you get your insurance renewal bill, as Mr. Silverstein just told you about, that $75 or $125, that's because of this garbage. It's not on law-abiding people to fix, Libby, and any conversation that suggests it irks me.
Defense lawyer Ari Goldkind, security expert, and former Toronto police officer Ross McLean, as well as Elliot Silverstein of CAA Insurance. This is Zoomer Radio's Best to Fight Back. I'm Bob Komsic. Coming up after the break, the cost of doing business with FIFA to land the World Cup for Toronto in 2 years.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Bob Komsic on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. More details have been revealed about the agreement former Mayor John Tory signed in order for Toronto to host 6 matches of the 2026 World Cup. The city is going to be required to make changes to everything from its transportation network to its public spaces, from its tax policy to who it does business with, in addition to tax breaks, free ad space, covering up unsightly construction, and a commitment to police the skies to protect FIFA's brand. Libby took the pulse of the Tune Into the Town panel. Councillor Paula Fletcher, Ward 14, Toronto Danforth. Councillor James Pasternak, Ward 6, York Centre. And Taylor Sklon, co-founder of The Peak.
My first thought was I'd love to be FIFA because they've got a great thing going here where they seem to take all the revenue and shoulder very little of the cost. But, you know, the exact terms, I thought there was nothing more shocking in those than really exceeded the sticker price of this thing of $380 million. I think the bigger issue here is that we really need to open up the processes that lead to these decisions. If the public is going to be on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars, we should have an insight into how these negotiations are going, what we're offering, what we're getting much earlier in the process than we have in this case, because clearly we're not getting a good deal out of it. You know, I went back and looked at some of the past hosts of the World Cup just to see what the experience was like for them. And I could only find one example of it ending up being a net positive for the city, and that was Barcelona. And, you know, I think it's been good for them. Tourism has gone up a lot in Barcelona, maybe because of that, maybe because of other reasons. We have a lot of other issues that need to be dealt with here, and that's going to be, you know, having garbage picked up off the streets, having potholes filled, having housing for people that they can afford would be much more appreciated amongst regular people in this city than a few World Cup games.
Olivia Chow, the mayor, says it's going to be transparent. But the fact is, when dealing with organizations like FIFA, you have to apparently agree to those things if you want the games. And if you don't agree to them, you won't get the games. Paula Fletcher.
Yeah, Libby, you're right. They hold all the cards, and I guess they're pretty canny negotiators. So how did we get this far and not know about it? And thank you to the crusading journalism of one Ben Spur. We know that there was a decision point in June of 2022 where something should have been brought to council to say, here's where we're at. No support here, no support there. Here's the things they want. Do you want to proceed? And there was a decision, I gathered, by the mayor and then city manager not to do that. So I kind of feel on this one, I feel pretty much like a mushroom up until we started getting this information. The other thing is, I think people should know that the Auditor General in the city, who has very wide scope to investigate, she said she's putting the FIFA on her work plan. So we're going to know a lot more, but it will be, the barn door has been closed. The horse is out of the barn, so we'll only know what happened. We won't be able to correct anything going forward.
The other thing that I question, so we always see these economic impact statements, and this one, I believe, I'm just looking, they're saying 3,600 jobs and $393 million in local GDP. But James Pasternak, we know that of the tax revenue generated by this, we are only going to get the crumbs.
I'm surprised people are surprised, because whenever you start negotiations with one of these major international organizations that bring either sports or cultural events to your city, like the Olympic Games or FIFA, or of course international exhibitions, you have very little bargaining power as a city, and because there's six other cities that will take it if you don't. And they set the rules, and what you have to do is try and maneuver your local economy to make sure you maximize it. In our situation, hotels, restaurants, confectionery, those are kind of the areas where it's an economic boost to our city. The other thing is the intangibles, such as our city will be on the world stage, and that is advertising that money cannot buy. And I think, you know, the other thing is, are we ready for prime time? This is a city that has never hosted an Olympic Games, never hosted an international exhibition, never hosted a Commonwealth Games. Pan Am Games was amazing. I went to some of the events. It changed the city for the positive. It left legacy infrastructure in sports and culture. And, of course, it was a great thing for the city as a whole.
The Tune In to the Town panel. Councillor James Pasternak, Ward 6, York Centre. Councillor Paula Fletcher, Ward 14, Toronto Danforth. And Taylor Sklon, co-founder of The Peak. This is Zoomer Radio's Best to Fight Back. I'm Bob Komsic for Jane Brown. Nearly 300 people in Ontario have been moved from hospitals to long-term care homes, not of their choosing, as a result of a controversial law brought in a little over a year ago. It can see those patients placed in homes up to 70 kilometers away or 150 kilometers if they're up north without their consent, and requires hospitals to charge them $400 a day if they refuse the transfer. The law is aimed at moving so-called alternate level of care patients who can be discharged from hospital but need a long-term care bed and don't yet have one in order to free up hospital space. The government says only a tiny percentage of LTC patients have been moved in this way, and as far as they know, that $400 a day has never been imposed. Joining Libby to discuss, NDP health critic Fran Gelina, Chief Executive Officer of the Registered Nurses Association, Dr. Doris Greenspoon, and Dr. Samir Sinha, Director of Geriatrics at Mount Sinai and the University Health Network Hospitals in Toronto.
Well, it sounds like a small number, but to me, it's a massive number, because these are nearly 300 individuals who had, in my view, their constitutional rights to be able to consent to where they would live for the rest of their lives not respected. This process, while the government makes it sound like it's an innocent thing, that it's not affecting many people, you have to remember there are thousands of other people who are being told, if you don't choose these homes, if you don't do this, we will force you to go to a home not of your choosing, and we will fine you $400 a day. And that's coercion, and that's not how we should be practicing healthcare. I don't think any nurse, any doctor, any social worker wants to be threatening people in a system that, frankly, doesn't have enough home care to allow people to return home, and doesn't have enough of the long-term care services we need to allow us to be able to respect people's choices. So I've been very upset about this bill. I don't think it's the right thing to do. Ontario is the only province that I know of that's enacted a policy where we no longer have to respect the patient's right to consent. And that's a line that we should never have crossed, and we should never have moved forward with.
Franchelina, the argument is, they say, okay, so which rights trump which other rights? So on the one hand, you have people who are stuck going to a place they did not choose. But what about all the people who are waiting for acute care, which is best delivered in the hospital? What about those people?
Well, you cannot take away the right of a frail elderly person to consent to have their medical information share, to consent to move to a home that is not 150 kilometers away, where they stand by themselves wondering, how come nobody comes to see me? How come nobody cares about me? That's because your wife is not able to drive 150 kilometers to go see you. Although she loves you and would like to support you, she can't. The choices that you are giving are false choice. We could invest in home care. We could keep the 90% of the people who are ALC who wants to go back home. We could do this if we had a government who understand that Our home care system is broken because they privatized it, and Bayshore makes hundreds of millions of dollars off of not offering quality care. Our hospital, or all of the people that don't have access to primary care, 2.2 million, they also depend on our hospital. This is a crisis of the making of this government.
What is a practical solution to the place that we are in now, Doris?
This is not a new situation. This has been for decades, going back even to Bob Rae when he was premier. Honestly, for decades and decades, all governments of all political stripes. And the shortfall on vision was to really build community care better, to build number one home care in a much stronger way, to build even primary care in a stronger way. The focus has been always hospitals, and now this is the situation. Let me say one thing. Hospitals are not the best place for older persons. No, they're not. They don't receive sufficient attention. So the choice for these 300 people was to be, quite frankly, not in the best place because it's not a priority care for people that are awaiting ALC. And I would love to see a survey of these 300 people to see their satisfaction of care now compared to before. That's number one, something very important.
Chief Executive Officer of the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario, Dr. Doris Greenspoon, NDP Health Critic Franz Elena, and Dr. Samir Sinha, Director of Geriatrics at Mount Sinai and the University Health Network Hospitals. I'm Bob Komsic, and you're listening to The Best of Fight Back. Coming up, what you had to say about the week that was, and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Bob Komsic.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics, and we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Frank in Concord wanted to talk about auto thefts.
Well, who do we have at the Port Authority? We got Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles. They don't see anything. They don't see all this deception and things going on, and we have the government and the auto manufacturers. You can't figure out how to not have your car stolen.
Lewis in Toronto wanted to talk about stadium capacity for BMO Field for the World Cup.
Did they ever consider the capacity of the stadium? Because I was reading that BMO, they had to put in another 5,000 feet or seats to bring it up to 45,000.
That's right.
Because they only had 40. And the 40,000 is nothing compared to other major cities that have bigger stadiums.
Carolyn in Bowmanville on long-term care at home.
This whole situation is very close to home for our family. My son-in-law has an incurable brain disorder to the point where there has to be home care. Being at home sounds like it's ideal, but if you're at home with only PSWs who come in for supposedly an hour but don't stay that long, and there is no family present because they have to work, you're by yourself.
John in Toronto on caring for your aging parents at home.
Yeah, it's deplorable that they're kicking these people out of the hospitals prematurely and sending them to old age homes that could be like sending them down a slippery slope highway to hell, because some of them didn't treat the old people elderly very well. And I think you all should take care of your parents. If you all got brothers and sisters, you all should live with your parents to extend their life if you really love them, instead of sweeping them to the side.
While Sita in Mississauga wanted to talk about Doug Ford not listening to people.
Out of the frying pan into the fire again. Oh, my God. You would think that Mr. Ford by now have learned from the past mistake, especially the green belt, and I can't believe he has more tricks to pull out of his hat by fooling in Lake Ontario for a spa that people aren't interested in.
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Lewis in Toronto, who does not see the harm in intermittent fasting.
Did they ever consider the capacity of the stadium? Because I was reading that BMO, they had to put in another 5,000 feet or seats to bring it up to 45,000.
That's right.
Because they only had 40. And the 40,000 is nothing compared to other major cities that have bigger stadiums.
That does it for this week's Best to Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us from noon to one weekdays, or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca, follow us on X at @FightbackLibby, and call our Fight Back voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Bob Komsic for Jane Brown. Join us again next weekend when we'll round up the best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Ziv Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.